Good morning. My name is Matt Espy. I'm from the University of California, Davis. And this might be a slight departure from some of the other talks, because this is half a physiological model, or half a process-based model and half a statistical model. Right off the bat, I'd like to acknowledge all of my co-authors on this paper. From the University of California, a cooperative extension from our department. So, because of limited time, I'm just going to jump straight into it. Why we looked at this first, we started off with a yield gap analysis for the U.S. under the GIGA project, which is the Global Yield Gap Analysis Project, I guess, and it's from Ken Kassman's group at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And so we conducted this analysis over the entire U.S., both southern U.S. and California, for U.S. rice production. And so as part of this, we used the ARISA physiological model to estimate yield potential, and then we used USDA reported yields for our attained yields, which is what farmers actually saw in the field. I'm not going to go over this figure. It's in field crops research. This is the results of the yield gap analysis and where we saw larger yield gaps and smaller yield gaps. But an immediate thing came up when we were conducting this analysis is there's huge temperature differences between California and the southern U.S. And then within each of those regions, there are temperature variations north to south. And so this is an indication of kind of in California, this isn't the finest granularity, but we do have a variation that goes north to south, south being cooler due to the proximity to the San Francisco Bay. We get cold winds that come in off that bay, and it really cools down the area right around here. And then as you go north, that influence is not quite as strong. And then same in the southern U.S. We've got really higher temperatures around Texas and Louisiana, and then as you move north, temperatures cool off. And we knew from previous research that this is anticipated to have an impact on yield. And so just as part of our analysis, we wanted to say, well, what is the impact of this yield? One of the surprising things, though, so we have the ARISA model that's been calibrated for all these regions, and we have observations. We can compare the two, and the ARISA model should theoretically reflect this warming trend as we moved from sites that are cooler to the sites that are warmer. And we did this. This actually didn't appear in the paper. It got cut by reviewers. I believe it still exists in the supplemental. And if not, it exists in the repository. But we did a comparison of our simulated yields using the physiological model and our attained yields, and we arranged them according to the average T-min during the growing season. And so from previous work, we expected to have a yield decrease as we get warmer temperatures, primarily driven by respiratory losses. The warmer it is, the more energy it requires to maintain standing plant tissue. So what we weren't expecting was that there's a difference between what the model is predicting and what we saw in the field. The model, basically, this is just a straight linear regression. The model is estimating about twice as much loss due to respiration, twice as much loss by this increasing temperature as what we actually saw in the observed data. And so that got us thinking, how big of an impact does this have? Simultaneously, we have other temperature drivers that exist in the system. As you heard previously, we know that warm and cool temperature during critical events can actually increase or decrease yield because it directly impacts yield components. And so that led us to start wondering, well, what is the relative impact of all of these different temperature-driven mechanisms on yield? And for that, I already got ahead of myself. So like I said, we know that cold and heat-induced sterility can have a large impact. Previous research has shown these respiratory losses can be quite large. They've been estimated at 10% per degree Celsius in some papers. The trouble is this part. It's really difficult to directly quantify these simultaneously in the field. And hopefully this is obvious, but I'm going to spend a little bit of time going through it. The trouble is to simultaneously estimate the impact of both. You have to have one condition without the other, which is actually really difficult in a natural system. You have to have heat stress, but not warm temperatures. Or you have to have cold stress, but not too cool of temperatures. And this is a bit of a problem. So not many, or to my knowledge, it hasn't been done at the field scale estimating both of these mechanisms. We have a bit of an advantage with our system, though. As I mentioned previously, California has this natural gradient. We've got these cool temperatures from the San Francisco Bay, and as you go north, it gets warmer. So just to kind of orient yourself, this is California. San Francisco is right here. This is the Bay Area. Berkeley would be here. The shaded region is the rice-growing areas of California. So the advantage that we have in California, or that we're trying to leverage, is that, one, we have this natural gradient going north-south. Two, we have a high density of weather stations. It might be a little hard to see, but the X's here are all weather stations that are recording these temperatures as we go north-south. And then the third advantage that we have is we, in California, as part of the UC extension, a cooperative extension, and in collaboration with the rice industry, we have long-term sites where we conduct breeding trials. And these sites are arranged north, south, east, west. So we have pretty good geographic coverage of this area that we know experiences these gradients. Then the last little bit that really is an advantage is we have, it's fairly arid in California during the growing season. It's a Mediterranean climate. Most of our precipitation happens in the winter. And so that aridity leads to large shifts in the temperature from day to night. So it's actually possible to have heat stress, but a cool night. Temperatures can easily exceed 40 degrees Celsius during the day and then dip below 15 degrees at night on occasion. So if we were going to be able to simultaneously estimate these, this is a good system to attempt it. We have all the ingredients. So we did just that. We're estimating the impacts of these increased temperature, min-max average, and then also cooling and warming point stress during critical stages. So vegetative reproductive, grain filling, and then for these seasonal stresses from respiration, we average over the entire season. Additionally, this cooling and heat stress, we calculated using a thermal time accumulation model that's pretty common in most of the physiological models. ERISA uses it, where you model the stress is an accumulation of events that go below a threshold. So once you're below a critical threshold, you start accumulating stress. And then the sum of that stress tells you how much yield loss you are expected to have in the model. So we basically pulled that out. And so this is the physiological-ish model. It's kind of an empirical model. But we use that to calculate our heating and cooling stress. Additionally, one thing that I don't touch here is we estimate all the thresholds as well. So if you're familiar with a lot of these models, they have a threshold that the user determines, and it's a set. We weren't sure for our varieties. They're bred for cool stress tolerance. So we need to actually estimate the thresholds as well as the accumulated cooling stress. But then you have all the trouble with observational studies. Even though the data were born from an experiment, it's really observational in nature because you have non-independence in time and space. So we have lots of observation. That's the good part. We have about 27,000 in this part of the study. We have about 21 years of data. That's the good news. The bad news is to really feel comfortable, we have to adjust for that non-independence in the data. So this is where the statistical part comes in, where the statistical model includes a bunch of covariates to try to account for non-independence in the data. This includes, but is not limited to, site-year interactions, the different varieties or cultivars that we're using. Sum total, we have over 2,000 covariates that we adjust for in this model. So we have a big statistical model. The full model was fit using Hamiltonian Monte Carlo, which is a MCMC approach. I'm trying to cut statistics out of my talk, so if you're interested, talk to me later. And then for anyone who's written these kind of models, you know, I wrote the model in about 2 days. It took 2 months to verify and test it, because that's the nature of the beast. It might have taken more than 2 months. So, but we tested it across a whole range of different simulated circumstances to ensure that we were picking up known variables. So if theoretically, we're going to pick up the signal if it's there. So the quick results. The results for our system is that in our system, these cooling events during booting, as was mentioned in a previous talk, where you have a cold event that causes sterility of the developing panicles, that was massive in our system. That was had the potential to cause far more losses than any of the other temperature mechanisms. In fact, the model essentially said that for our system, temperate rice, once you know the cool stress at booting, you have a lot of information about the variability of that of yield. The seasonal mean temperature, which is previously estimated to be a really large impact, for our system, the model is saying once you know this, this accounts for a very small amount of extra variability. And so you can see here, for us, the three biggest effects are these point stresses, where you have an event that causes direct loss of yield components, that those were really causing variability in our yields, and that these warming temperatures were not as large of a contributor. And these are just some estimates. We did see some differences between our grain types. So this is, on the bottom we have, these are standardized scores. So it's standardized at 0 is no cold stress, 4 is the most cold stress that we saw in our study. And we've got cooling boot, flowering for cooling, flowering for heating, and then the seasonal mean. And you can kind of see the slopes of the lines. Not unexpectedly, our short grain varieties showed the least impact by these point stresses. The short grain varieties in California have been bred for a cold tolerance. They're especially adapted to our system. Followed by the medium grains, and then the long grains, which are closer to a southern U.S. type of rice, showed the largest impacts by this these cooling scores. And then again, once, as I said previous, once you know these pieces of information, knowing the mean temperature or even the temperature during any one of these individual intervals doesn't provide a lot of extra information. And then just a brief thing, we were curious, well, because we have a long-term study, it's natural to think, well, are we seeing increased temperature and this is actually an effect of newer observations versus older observations? At least over the study period, we didn't see a large, this actually goes back about 10 years prior to our study, and looks at the number of days that occur under the threshold that we say cold stress happens at, and then the seasonal mean temperatures. These lines are just a replicated posterior estimate. And really, for our system, for this short interval, we didn't see a large effect. We didn't see general warming, although we know from kind of larger scale observations that it's happening. So we didn't see changes really in the change in the threshold, the occurrence of the threshold, or in the seasonal mean. So the interesting next step is, well, can we do anything about this? This is a little problematic because these stress events are unpredictable. If you have them, we've now estimated that you lose a lot of yield, but it's possible that you will not have a stress event during the growing season and then yield is unaffected. So what can we recommend on the ground to that farmers can act on this? The biggest thing is we can adjust when the crop is flowering. So up at the top we see our observed TMN for every site for the entire study period. So you end up with this little cloud of points, and you can see that we have as we go later in the season, as expected, we're seeing the temperatures start to drop. But there's this flat area, kind of at the pinnacle of the curve, where really we're not seeing a big change. And this flat area lines up with where we usually see our two reproductive events, budding, which is where the panicle is developing, and then flowering, where the flower has actually emerged and is starting to develop into grain. And our recommendation is really, if we can push these events earlier in the season, not too early, because if we go too early, we're seeing more minimum temperatures that are below that threshold. We can actually possibly avoid some of these stress events if they were to occur. So really quick conclusions. I know that was a lot of, there's a lot more. This paper's been accepted, published, so I can point you there if you have questions about some of the details. But the main conclusions are that we do see an impact of both respiratory losses and point stresses, but the point stresses currently outweigh the respiratory losses for our system. And that really, as we estimate, they're likely fairly small. So we're thinking about how to affect the timing of flowering events, of reproductive events, to avoid these point stresses. And this really could lead to better yield stability in our trials and in our farms. This is the trouble. Point stresses are unpredictable. There's a fair amount of research that says they will increase in frequency as we go forward, but kind of knowing that this is driving our yields in this system, we can hopefully start breeding for better tolerance, better resistance. And then this last one is, so we did this in California because we have this natural system that allowed us to do this. I guess you could say it's a natural experiment. We don't really know how this compares to tropical systems. So there's going to need to be some more work. We know that the models are not quite accurately representing the relationship in the southern U.S., but I think this is worth looking at, trying to get a better handle on where the vulnerabilities of our system lies. And with that, I'd like to thank our funding sources, the UC Davis Department of Plant Sciences, California Rice Research Board, the USDA, and special thanks to the Agroecology Lab and Bruce Lindquist for all the help. Feel free to ask me questions if there's time.
Thank you. Time for questions. Yes, this concludes the session.
The session.
Wanted code may not be only the absolute temperature.
Yes.
I'm thinking maybe it's related to how warm, how hot it is today. And so my question is, have you looked at the temperature difference?
Mm-hmm. So that's an excellent question. So the question was that these effects might not just be a function of absolute temperature, but it might be an effect of what the temperature was previously. So we do know that there is an accumulation that plants can kind of adapt if the change is gradual versus if it's rapid. We didn't look at that, and In my personal opinion, I think this is really where the model, further developing the models would be really helpful, because we know that the models are not capturing these dynamics well from previous work, and it's really hard to capture that in the field. So modeling is helpful. So it's a great question, and I wish I knew the answer. Yes?
Next question.
I'm wondering why you describe the increased temperature of the respiration instead of something like shortening the season.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't talk about that.
I did not. So the question was, why did we describe that we're increasing temperature, but we didn't really talk about phenology or the development of the crop over time. So the perhaps two basic answers that we did think about that, and it's accounted for in those covariates. Like I said, we adjusted for a lot of things. One of them is the development. So we have observed date of heading. But part of the complication of this is that we have a change in varieties, and in general in California rice, we've been moving towards earlier varieties. And so there's a bit of a collinearity, or it's going to be difficult to separate out the development versus the adoption of varieties that are also shorter duration. I think it's an excellent question. I think it's something we could look at in the future. I'm trying to think if we have the data for it. So in this case, we relied on the statistical model to adjust for that, rather than having a physiological component in the model of a phenology-driven development. Does that make sense? Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that you can't analyze it, as you said, because of the changing variety.
Mm-hmm.
But I would anticipate that it's a bigger influence than the restoration.
Yeah, it's a really what would you say, like a warty subject. There's a lot of different things that all go into it, and it's one of the complications of doing this type of study is that we can't end up with a perfect separation of all these different factors. And so what we've attempted to do here is we've tried to supplement it with lots of data and fairly sophisticated statistical techniques. As I mentioned earlier, I think with further development of crop models and getting them more accurate, if the crop models were more accurate, we'd feel more comfortable applying them to this problem. But right now, based on our previous study, we know that there are some deficiencies in the crop models, and so we're falling back to empirical approaches. And yeah, I'm hoping that more scientific progress can change that. Yes?
I have a question. In your early slides, you have seen the yield, you write up version 3 and once you have observed the yield, there's a big gap between the two.
Yep. So go ahead.
Why is there a big gap?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. So the question was in the very early slide where I showed ARISA versus attained yields. Why is there a huge gap? The answer is we were modeling yield potential. And the attained yields, that was actually what was being attained in the farm. And in that system, there's a large yield gap. Farmers are not attaining yield potential, or so we estimate. So that's why that large gap between the two. In California, so I cut California off because it's southern U.S. way on one side and then California way on the other. But in California, the gap is much smaller because the yield gap is smaller.